I need you to pack your best prairie dresses in your cutest suitcase and come to the Young Women's Leadership Summit, June 7th through 9th, San Antonio, Texas. First speaker drop was announced. We have Erica Komisar, one of my biggest guests ever, talking about the first couple years of a child's life, the dangers of daycare on attachment. Oh my gosh, this is going to throw the left for a loop. I have word that we have one of the biggest experts in hormonal birth control speaking on the main stage. Ali Beth Stuckey, Riley Gaines, Taylor Dukes. If you know Taylor Dukes, she has an incredible testimony of beating brain cancer holistically. That obviously is someone I'm really excited to hear about because my dad right now is battling the same thing. Oh my gosh, some of the names that haven't even been announced yet. Like, you're not ready. You're not ready. There has never been a lineup that has basically just been either dream spillover guests that haven't been on the show that I've always wanted to come on the show, or people that have been my biggest guests ever that you guys have liked. Okay, I'm rambling. YWLS2024.com, code Alex for 25% off. This is the biggest all ages women's conference in the conservative movement. It is unlike anything you've ever been to. There is a theme. It is so specifically for women. Come, whether you know a bunch of people or you know nobody at all, YWLS2024.com, code Alex. I could talk for 5 days on this, but we got to get to the show. Is your child ever sad? They might need therapy. Do they resist being told no?
No.
They might need therapy. Struggle paying attention in class? Well, drugs, of course, but also therapy. Gen Z is the most emotionally distressed generation. They've also received more therapy than any other generation. So what is really going on here? There's allegedly a mental health crisis, but we seem to be deploying more help than ever before. Why then isn't the emotional state of kids improving? Best-selling investigative journalist and author of Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters, is back with another literary bombshell, Bad Therapy, an investigation into how mental health overdiagnosis is harming, not helping, children. If you prefer to see who you're listening to, watch this interview over on The Real Alex Clark YouTube channel. This show is made possible by donations from listeners like you. If you find yourself regularly listening to the show and have the financial means to do so, you can leave a tax-deductible donation through the link in the show notes. A 5-star review every time you listen on Apple or Spotify is a free way to support us that also really helps. Please welcome, for the second time, journalist and author Abigail Schreier to The Spillover. Abigail, you were my second interview ever on The Spillover. That was 3 years ago. And so I loved your first book. When I found out that you were writing the second one, I was like, I have to have her on again to discuss this one. Of course, it was just as electrifying as the first read.
Thank you.
You're one of my favorite journalists and authors, period, I think, right now. Your new book, Bad Therapy, talks about how we're in the middle of this mental health crisis. But I want to know how much of this, ironically, is being fueled by the same people saying that they want to end it.
Yeah, that's the thesis of the book. The thesis of the book is, look, we have a rising generation. They have gotten more mental health treatment than any in the recorded American history. So more psychotherapy, more diagnosis, more medication. And they are the least happy. They've had more wellness tips, by the way, more emotional regulation, coping mechanisms and such. So why aren't they the picture of wellness? They aren't. They're the picture of despair. So I really wanted to know why.
Why isn't talking to a therapist good for everyone?
That's a great way of saying it, because, of course, I'm not anti-therapy. I mean, therapy can be valuable, especially for adults. There's a body of research out there on the known risks of therapy, right? Any intervention that has the potential to help also necessarily has the potential to harm, right? An X-ray, Tylenol, all these things come with risks, right? You take them if you need them is the shorthand. But there's something else too. With children, it's different. Children don't have the power to say, listen, I think we're putting a little too much blame on my mom, or I guess that wasn't nice of my mom, but I wouldn't call it emotional abuse. Or I know I was teased in middle school, but I don't think I have PTSD. an adult can say those things. And those are the known harms of therapy. And there's a great body of research on this, as I said. The known harms of therapy include like making your anxiety worse, making PTSD worse, making depression worse, alienating you from a spouse or from your parents. And also the biggest, and we're seeing this all over this generation, a feeling of inefficacy, like I can't do for myself. I'm limited in some way by my diagnosis.
Something that really struck me was you discovered that the types of people who we would think would benefit the most from therapy, burn victims, police officers, for example, they exhibited worse mental health after therapy than before.
That's right. So there are these really good studies out there that every researcher, by the way, is aware of. It's the practitioners who seem to deny it. But the extended control group did not go to therapy, and then the other group went to group therapy. And they did this with first responders. They've done it with breast cancer victims, breast cancer survivors, and PTSD victims. And again, they have found that very often the group that went to therapy emerged sadder and with more symptoms of depression or anxiety or whatever it is they were there to treat. And the reason is, and this is sort of the story that's not being told to this generation, but it should, all the research shows, we are built for resilience. We are built to overcome, okay? You go back to any of our families and you will find loss, you will find, you know, suffering, you will find abuse. And there, in every family, there's a story of people picking themselves up. That doesn't mean it's pleasant, but picking themselves up and going out there and forming families and having jobs and being good neighbors and being good citizens, not sitting around on their parents' couch.
Are there any circumstances where therapy was really helpful for somebody?
Yes, when you need it. When you need it, when you can't stabilize without it, especially for a child, it should only be in that circumstance.
But it's not what all these teenagers are saying. Right. I need therapy. I can't stabilize. I'm so depressed.
This is a completely wrong idea that everyone would benefit from therapy. Okay. The reason it's wrong is because there are these known risks, right? Tylenol. I love Tylenol. I take it whenever I have a headache, but if I took it every day, I would end up with liver damage. And the same is true for therapy. People who go to therapy regularly, and remember, most of the therapy in this generation, a lot of it's coming through the schools. A lot of it's coming through the parents, and they're all following the techniques of therapists. They're all doing this so-called trauma-informed care, or in the case of parents, they're doing gentle parenting, which is a therapeutic method. And all of it's supposed to get kids to focus on their feelings. Well, that focus is the best way to dysregulate kids.
If there are risks to therapy, why are we only ever told the benefits?
It's crazy. I think part of the problem is that the profession doesn't acknowledge risks or track them. So, for instance, there is this body of literature, of course, but, you know, the known harms of therapy, there's a lot of disagreement within the field about whether, for instance, a divorce is a good or bad therapeutic outcome. So because they can't agree on those things, they don't make any effort to track them. And very often, if they were to track them, they would find, and researchers who have done this work have found, that actually some people will emerge from therapy with worse interpersonal relationships. Now, you might say, why? That doesn't make sense, because all they're doing is focusing on fixing their relationships. Well, sometimes when you're sitting around with your therapist, it leads you to an idea that actually my wife's a lot worse than I realized. Or my mom's a lot worse than I realized. She is toxic. And I interviewed this wonderful clinical psychologist, Joshua Coleman, who's also an author, who deals with family estrangement. So the rates of young people cutting off their parents is higher than we've ever seen before. And he said that in his, you know, from his work and his research, in almost every case, a therapist is at the center of it.
What does that mean? Kids are cutting off their parent more than ever before.
Young adults are saying they no longer speak to their family members. That's a fairly new as a you know, significant phenomenon in American life. People who say, my parents are toxic, they're emotionally abusive. Now we're talking here about loving parents, because as he told me, as Joshua Coleman told me, and others confirmed, that very often people who were actually abused by their parents, they're actually very often more desperate for the relationship. But the people who seem to be cutting off their parents in alarming numbers when they reach adulthood very often were raised very gently by their parents in the most loving homes. But for whatever reason, then they went off to therapy and decided, no, this was toxic and emotional abuse.
Even with pharmaceutical drugs, if there is a high risk after taking said pharmaceutical that you're going to increase anxiety, depression, suicidal thoughts, then you get that warning packet, right? If those same outcomes could happen after more therapy, shouldn't every therapy session begin with, hey, just so you know, there are risks after so many sessions, you might experience an increased amount of anxiety, depression, suicidal thoughts. That would make sense to me.
Absolutely. And I actually have met therapists who do that. It's extraordinarily rare, but it is good practice. Absolutely. They should also limit the sessions. You don't treat especially a child as an annuity, as an income, a permanent income stream. But all the, unlike what you mentioned, drugs, they're federally, doctors are federally required to report harms, right? Drug interactions, bad side effects. They have to. It's part, they're looking for it. But here's the thing, with a doctor, they get to keep the patient. So even after they report it, okay, they report the harm of the medicine, but they get to keep the patient. If a psychotherapist says to you, listen, our therapy seems to be hurting you. It's an admission that the therapy isn't good. Now it's time to move to someone else. So they lose the patient. So the incentives are all wrong. They are incentivized to treat the least sick for the longest period of time.
That is interesting that you say that. And I think about Alex Cooper from the popular podcast, Call Her Daddy. She is real big on therapy. Everybody needs a therapist. And she has had her therapist for years and years and years. And I would say she is a pretty normal, stable person. I mean, obviously, we don't know everything about everyone, but she is one of those prime examples where I look at and I'm like, why are you still seeing your therapist? It must not be working. I think that's a sign that your therapy isn't working if you're with them for years and years and years.
Well, let me give you an example because I'm hearing this story all the time, but I tell the story in my book. So this I called the young woman I called Becca, and I interviewed her when she was 17, but she had been in therapy since she was six because her parents divorced. So she didn't have a problem. She didn't have a mental health problem, but automatically, when she turned, you know, when she was six and her parents divorced, they put her in therapy, even though she had had no mental health problem. It was just done automatically. I talked to her when she was 17. She had been in therapy for that many years. And I asked her, so what are you working on? And she said, well, I'm going off to college next year and I'm working with my therapist on how to make friends in college. I've never been very good at making friends. So we're working on it and talking about the ways I've tried to make friends in the past. Now, do you see what happens? This is a classic side effect of therapy. Teaching kids they can't do. They can never take a risk. They can never try. These are the things we used to consider normal. And in fact, if you look across this generation, they're not taking risks. There are no tech founders in this generation. They're afraid to get their license. They're afraid to ask a girl out on a date.
You wrote, even when patients' symptoms are made worse by therapy, they tend to think therapy has helped. You explain that this is because they're not checking objective markers. What does that mean?
So no one is in most therapy, no one is saying, okay, let's measure our anxiety to certain responses. Now let's try again. Okay, you were having trouble in your relationships. You were unhappy. Now let's see, how unhappy are you with your spouse today? Let's see if it's better or worse than it was a year ago. No one's measuring that.
So the therapy industry almost needs more regulation, is what I'm hearing. Am I wrong in that?
It needs more guidelines. Absolutely. Where should they come from? I don't know. But the industry right now does nothing to police itself. And so, you know, look, when we vent, we feel purged. But very often, I mean, I'm hearing this all the time. I was with my therapist for 5 years and I felt just as depressed at the end of it. And if you look, are you more successful in your job? Whatever you came to therapy, no one's measuring that it gets better. See, in medical offices, they are generally measuring it. Oh, my rash went away.
Where are all my coffee drinkers at? I'm excited to share with you something new and different that I've actually never heard of before. Infrared roasted coffee. I didn't know this, but every coffee out there, no matter what brand you drink, is what they call conventionally roasted. This basically means that the beans are subject to the flames and fumes, which is why almost all coffees are bitter tasting and actually acidic. Infrared roasting keeps the flames away from the beans in this proprietary process, which makes for not only an incredible taste, but low to no acid. But that's not all. The Spillover's newest sponsor is the Patriot Red Coffee Company. Not only do they use this infrared roasting process, but they're a conservative patriot-driven company that is giving a full 10% of their sales back to conservative causes and initiatives. I'm being told that their red special version also blends in the coffee fruit itself. Did you know that coffee beans come from a coffee fruit? Well, it turns out this fruit has a very high antioxidant value and is really healthy for you. And they actually put it back into the ground coffee. Sounds interesting, right? If you'd like to try this coffee, Patriot Red Coffee Company is offering to send you a couple of samples in their cool little single serve pour overs. All you have to do is pick up the shipping. Go to patriotred.com/TPUSA and use the code Alex, where you can also get $10 off your first order if you want to just go ahead and buy a bag. They even have K-cups. Try it at patriotred.com/TPUSA and use the code Alex, where you can also get $10 off your first order or try some free samples. Find the link and code in the show notes of today's episode in case you forget. That's patriotred.com/TPUSA with code Alex.
The numbers of therapists have exploded. In the American Psychological Association, between 1946 and 1960, membership in the APA quadrupled. Then, until 1980, it quadrupled again. So you're seeing a vastly expanding industry. Since World War II, the effort has been to treat the worried well. And that's what they're doing. They're treating people who fundamentally don't need therapy.
So Gen Z is now graduating from college. They are the most therapized. What's the word? Gen Z has gone to therapy more than any other generation. Are they happier?
No, they're more miserable by every objective marker, right? We look at it in a society to see if people are happy. Are they forming families? Are they forming relationships? Are they holding down steady jobs? And they give all, you know, kinds of reports. By every measure, this is an unhappy generation. It's also a generation that we taught to focus on their feelings relentlessly. They have what I call in the book, emotional hypochondriasis. They are emotional hypochondriacs. Now, what does that mean? A hypochondriac, I talked to this wonderful man, Arthur Barsky, who's a world expert in hypochondriasis, or what they now call illness anxiety disorder. What is it? It's not people faking illness, okay? It's people whose hyperfocus magnifies the real pain we all feel. And when people who are hypochondriacs turn it into an organizing principle of their life, they can't get past their pain. It gets more and more debilitating. And that's what we're seeing emotionally with these kids. They have magnified their feelings to such huge proportions that they feel that they need to get their boss fired. They need to go to HR and get their boss fired because he said something that hurt their feelings. It's that extreme to them.
Well, people are going to say it's the social media, and you agree with that, that that plays a part, but you actually think that it's a lot deeper than that. Can you elaborate?
I do. Look, social media is bad, and it's acted as an accelerant for all sorts of problems, including mental health problems. But let me just give you one example. In 2016, one in six children between the ages of 2 and 8 had a mental health diagnosis in this country. That's a lot of kids. They weren't on social media. They're not on social media now, but definitely not in 2016, they weren't. So we're seeing all these normal kids being pathologized, all these normal behaviors being pathologized. And I remember you mentioned on your show, and I thought this was a classic example. You hear this all the time. You mentioned when you had Roger McPhillan on, you said, I was feeling stress. I went to my doctor and I said, my work's really gotten stressful. And he's, instead of saying, yeah, you're in a stressful job, you're performing every day, it's growing, you're getting more responsibility, you're going to have more stress. He said, why don't we try Lexapro? Mm-hmm. And here's what I want people to know. It's a misunderstanding of life. It's not just about big pharma and making money. It's that we have misunderstood life and we have mis-explained it to children. We have told them that any distress is something to be deleted with medication. We don't tell them what's true, which is that lots of life is hard. Some of it's good. It's good when we face adversity, when we try harder, it's good. And sometimes it's a signal that we're doing something wrong, that we need to make a change. But if you go in and delete that with medication, there are a lot of problems that could come. But one of it is you may lose the will to make the life change you need to make.
Just to put it into perspective, what are the rates of ADHD, depression, and anxiety in young kids right now?
It's a good question. So these numbers vary. Something like 20% of boys between the ages of 12 and 17 are now diagnosed with ADHD. Okay. With depression, the numbers vary, and there's a question of how much is self-reporting. But let me give you a better statistic than how many are self-reporting with depression, because we know these kids are exaggerating. So how do we know? We know these kids are taught, they don't even use the word sad anymore. They're so flooded with therapy that they never say they're sad. They say, I'm depressed. They never say, I'm worried. They say, I'm anxious, right? They never say, I'm shy. I have social phobia. So how do we know they actually are acting more like depressed people? Because rehearsing their past pain is the number one symptom of depression. Rumination, this pathological, constantly revisiting a past injury or a past pain. And that's what they're doing so much of. That we know is a major symptom of depression.
The other thing that really fascinates me is the autism explosion. But what I mean by that is I just don't believe that all of these kids have autism. We have more kids that are autistic than ever before. But also, I think that we are diagnosing kids with autism that don't actually have it. So let me explain what I mean. Last night, I'm scrolling on TikTok. I find this girl and she shows the what her doctor wrote that led him to believe that she had autism. And she was like, look how cool this is. But I'm reading it and I'm like, if this is what it means to have autism, and then everybody's autistic, because her doctor wrote that she loves listening to Lana Del Rey and Hilary Duff obsessively, that she spends a lot of time with her cat. She crochets a lot, listens to the same artists over and over. I do all of these things. I mean, I'm obsessed with Taylor Swift. She's the background of my phone. I listen to her obsessively. I like wait, you know, and analyze every lyric of her album when it comes out. It says that she prefers being home than going out. So do I. I'm not autistic. There was nothing in this description of her alleged autism diagnosis. I mean, and I'm not a professional, but I just feel like it's common sense. Like these kids, some of them, I don't even think have autism.
Yeah. And the reason it's not funny, the reason it's to be taken seriously is you might just laugh. A lot of people call them snowflakes and laugh. I don't do that. And I'll tell you why. Because having a mental health diagnosis is a profound event. It's not neutral. People who think they're shy, they just say, okay, I can do it. I can overcome my shyness. But if you have a mental disorder, what you're saying is, I need someone else to come help me. I need a drug or a therapist or somebody else. I can't do it on my own. Now, if you have a disorder, by all means, get the help you need. But that's different than young, healthy people talking themselves into incapacity. And that's what we're seeing. That's why they don't want to go for it. That's why they don't know that life is an adventure, because they don't feel up to its challenges.
Are therapists rewarding emotional suffering?
Sure, they get a patient forever. I mean, yeah, yes, they are. I mean, they casually throw around diagnoses. I'll give you an example. Mom wrote to me the other day who had read my book. It was so nice. She wrote to me, she said, thank God for your book, and here's why. My daughter has dyslexia, and we realized she has really reading struggles. And I told my pediatrician and he said, oh, that's going to be a lot for her to deal with. She should start on therapy and an antidepressant to help her handle it. That is how casually these things are being introduced. Look, if you have a reading problem, you tell a kid, it's no big deal. We're going to get this sorted out. Deal with, you absolutely get help. But you don't pile on medications a child doesn't need, because now you're messing with things like emotional coping, emotional resources, which she won't be able to develop. You're messing with, depending on the age, sex drive, all putting on weight, all the side effects of pouring an antidepressant into a child who doesn't need it.
Well, that was one of the scariest things about my Dr. McPhillan interview, was him talking about antidepressants, anti-anxiety meds, inducing this type of like sexual numbness that you could develop after only like a week of taking it, basically immediately for life, that it never goes away. An inability to have a fully fulfilled sex life, feeling sensations down there and all this kind of stuff, just completely numbed on people.
And here's the problem. If an adult starts on an antidepressant, he or she's going to know, hey, I don't like the way I feel. I might need to taper. And at that point, probably you should use the help of a physician to get off a drug, because these are really the powerful withdrawal symptoms are no joke.
Well, they also have enough life to compare and contrast before and after the pill to know that something's not right. A kid has no past life experience to say this pill's making me feel weird. They don't know.
That's the problem. Exactly. You go in and delete a child's sex drive before they're developing a sex drive, they won't know what they're missing. And that's what we're seeing in this generation, a generation of numbed kids to life. They don't have any natural coping abilities, and they don't even know what they're missing.
This therapy obsession, is it mostly just happening with kids, or is it adults? It's American culture. I mean, maybe it's worldwide. I don't know.
It's the culture, and it's definitely very extreme here.
Why America?
We love a pill. We love a quick solution in this country. I think we've been that way for a long time. And, you know, after World War II, we moved Congress greenlit this so-called preventive mental health care. Now, we've never been good at preventive mental health care. We're good at, to some extent, at treating actual disorders, you know, to varying degrees, but treating preventatively, prophylactically, we've never been able to do. But nonetheless, the lion's share of our mental health resources are going to kids who don't need them through schools. And also they're guiding all the parents. Therapists are guiding parents. I mean, if you've ever heard a mom say to a child, "You're having some big feelings. I can see that you're very angry." What does she do? She's imitating a therapist.
Speaking of preventative mental health, I think a lot of that, too, now everybody's pushing it because they're like, this is how we're going to prevent the next school shooting, is preventative mental health care. Did you look into that in the research of this book at all? The everyone being on pills, everybody having a therapist, but then also we have these mass shootings happening with kids?
Right. I mean, many people have pointed out, and this is not research I've independently done, but many people have pointed out that a lot of the school shooters seem to already be on various antidepressants. We know that suicidal ideation and suicidality are side effects of antidepressants for reasons that are not well understood, especially with adolescents. We don't know why. And so the point, again, is not that no child should ever be on an antidepressant, but we definitely need to take the risks a whole lot more seriously and be a whole lot less casual about starting a kid on these things.
What's the problem with a therapist coaching a child on how to make friends?
Kid won't know he can do it on his own. You're undermining the kid's sense of efficacy, his sense of going for it, right? Daring do. This was the stuff we were so good at in this country. We used to know, see, when parents educated their kids on just morality, right and wrong, you don't hit another kid, you treat people fairly, you don't pick on a weaker kid than you, that's bullying. And if you do things that are bad, I'm going to punish you. I'm going to send you to your room. You're going to have to, you know, or I'm going to take away the toy you just hit your sister with, or whatever it is, okay? When parents sent down those guidelines, not only did kids feel calmer, we know that authoritative parenting has always been the best for kids, but which is loving and rule-based. Parents are ultimately in charge, not mom's therapist, but the parents are in charge, okay? Not only is that good for kids, but then we can trust our kids. We could trust them because you know right and wrong. Now go ahead and walk home from school.
It seems like a lot of parents are just outsourcing the parenting duty to absolutely everyone else in the peripheral of their child's life. Their teacher should raise them. Their youth group leader should raise them. Their doctor, their therapist. I mean, it just seems like the parents are doing very little raising. It's mostly just they're asking everyone else to do it.
And I ask, you know, why? Not just, yes, I think that's true, but why? And my conclusion was that parent confidence is so undermined by all these so-called experts who have told them, no, you don't know your kid's brain well enough to set down rules for your own kids. If you don't understand the fight or flight impulse and the amygdala, you're not ready to raise kid. It's nonsense. It was always nonsense. We have been raising good people to adulthood for how many generations now? But it's so undermined parents' confidence. And then they were afraid that anytime they yelled at a kid or punished a kid, it could cause emotional trauma.
Who is afraid of that more? Millennials as parents or Gen X?
Millennials are the most afraid of all. They're the ones who believe in therapy more than any other, even more than Gen X. And they have absolutely been aping all the techniques from the therapist. They're the ones doing this gentle parenting, which involves constantly affirming a child's feelings. Oh, I see that you're so angry that you didn't want chicken for dinner. You just threw it on the floor. Can we think of something else we might have done? I understand why you'd be so angry. What's the problem with that? Okay, it sounds nice. It's very seductive, okay? Affirming your child's pain, affirming their feelings, recognizing them and telling them that's okay. It's very seductive. Why shouldn't we do that? Well, With an adult, if you're a non-judgmental therapist, which is what therapy is, right? Maybe an adult just wants a place to go without shame to talk about some of the things they've done or experienced in their life. And that's understandable. But a child is trying to figure out, is trying to calibrate, is this a proper response? Is the fact that I wanted macaroni instead of chicken a reason to scream and throw the food at my mother? And the parent has to tell them no. No, that's not something to get angry about. I know you're feeling lots of things, but anger is not appropriate.
You wrote that some of these parents in gentle parenting groups brag about the fact that they've never told their kid no.
Yeah, many of them do. The whole idea is you don't say no. You just affirm their feelings and give them choices and always place yourself as a resource on the same level as your kid. Never exert your own authority. And we know, and this is old research, it's the most replicated research, psychological research going back to the 1960s. Kids need their parents to be in charge, which doesn't mean being unloving. It means loving and rule-bound. It means ultimately parents are in charge.
There's also this group of parents who feel like their kid can never be out of their sight. I have to be watching every move they make. They can never play out of my line of sight. What are we seeing in the development of those children as they get older?
They don't trust themselves. They stay in the cage. They've been raised in the cage and they don't want to leave it. They're not growing up. You have to raise kids. Risk taking is what makes kids stronger. And yes, that means getting your heart broken. And yeah, that means sitting next to an obnoxious kid in class without having mom call the teacher and move your seat. Because you have to learn that someone can say a mean thing to you without your mom calling the school and complain that you've been bullied. Because you haven't been. It's not true. One mean comment to you, that's life. And you're going to be just fine. And that's the message they need to hear.
Wake up to skin that's plumped, nurtured, and radiantly healthy. Packed with vitamins, essential fatty acids, and hydrators, its unique texture comforts and softens skin through the night. The soothing lavender oil fragrance ensures a calm, relaxing sleep, while the cream works to rejuvenate your complexion. I want radically good skincare, not radical politics. If you feel the same way, then you're going to love Nimi Skincare, who is virtually one of the only companies that's not going to take your money and give it to politicians that hate you as a Christian conservative. Nimi's overnight recovery sleep mask is formulated without parabens, phthalates, and sulfates, and is great for all skin types. I like sleeping with it on, but you can also wash it off before bed if you prefer. Try modern skincare with timeless values at NimiSkincare.com and get 10% off with code AlexClark. That's NimiSkincare.com with code AlexClark for 10% off, or click the link in the show notes. How does gentle parenting encourage violence?
Well, the kids don't learn any emotional regulation. And there are all of their emotions, no matter how extreme, are affirmed. So what are we seeing in the rising generation? Look, there was a story the last year, young members of Gen Z, I guess the oldest members of Gen Z, got one of the most famous organic chemistry professors in our country, a man who taught at NYU, fired. Why? Literally, this was the reason. Because his grading system, meaning he failed a certain number of pre-meds every year, failed to take their feelings and their wellness into account. This is a generation that so believes its feelings are a guide to right and wrong. Its feelings are the most important thing in the world, because that's what they've been told by their teachers, by their parents, that they show up at work and they want to get their boss fired if he hurts their feelings.
Okay, so how many professors in schools go along with that type of behavior and are passing and graduating med students, for example, that act that way? That don't actually deserve the degree.
Well, that man was fired. He had written the classic textbook on organic chemistry. My understanding is he was one of the, if not the most important professor of organic chemistry in the country.
Right. So that means the school sided with those crazy kids.
Yes.
But what I'm saying, I'm scared of the future generation of lawyers, doctors, the people that are making decisions are judges that graduated, who knows, obviously, maybe not merit.
The thing to know is that these kids are not just tyrannizing each other with their emotions. They're tyrannized themselves. Their emotions are so out of control because we've told them time and again, your emotions are the most important thing. We're going to stop everything. We're going to bring the family to a halt if you're upset over what mom served for dinner.
So imagine when you and I, Abigail, are way older. We're elderly. We're sick. Maybe we need medical care in the hospital. And those are the kids who are our doctors. And they find out like the life work of you and I and the things that we did and the things that we stood for. I am thinking those are the kids that are going to say, your work and who you are hurts my feelings. I'm pulling the plug on you. That's the kind of extremes that I worry about with
this. Okay, so I have a reverse scenario that I like to think about, and that is, of all the problems we face in the country, this is the easiest to turn around.
Okay.
We know how to raise good kids in this country. We just need to stop getting confused by the experts and start doing it. And let me tell you something. Kids who are raised with more toughness, with a little more independence, with right and wrong, with authoritative parents who set high expectations for them, those kids, when they go to medical school, they're going to be the best, top of their class. And let me tell you something, they're going to be able to charge us whatever they want.
So did you talk to families who the parents said, yeah, we did more authoritative parenting and see what their kids had turned out like around college age?
I didn't have to because this is the most replicated studies we have. It goes back to a wonderful psychologist named Diana Bomrind of the 1960s. By the way, needless to say, it's very unpopular research, but they've replicated it hundreds of times. And what they found is that not authoritarian, not cold, unloving, and rule-bound parenting, and not permissive, anything-goes parenting, but the most successful, the happiest, the most well-adjusted kids are always the kids from authoritative families.
And the kids that struggle the most, what parenting style did their parents use?
So it's either the authoritarian, which basically doesn't exist anymore. These are people who put obedience at all costs and they're unloving. It basically doesn't exist in America today. And there's permissive. Now, permissive doesn't exist either because what we have today is worse than permissive. It's, I will never punish. I will never assert my authority with my kids. I will never say no, but I'm also going to surveil them. It's what I call surveillance parenting. I have to completely rearrange the world to make them happy because I can't trust their judgment with anything. So at least with the permissive parenting of old, at least they had a little independence. These kids today, they have none.
We're now giving kids what you call chemical chaperones. What is going to happen with the next generation of adults who have been numbed emotionally since childhood because they've been on prescription medications?
I think we're already seeing it. Kids go through completely routine life events like being rejected by someone you liked or getting a grade that you didn't want, you know, a failing grade or whatever, and they're having absolute nervous breakdowns over it. They're having mom call their bosses. Which I heard time and again, mom is calling their bosses to because they can't do it themselves.
Let me tell you something. Yeah. I don't know that I've ever shared this publicly, but there's another girl that I pissed off in the conservative movement. She had her mom complain to my boss and say that I should be fired.
There you go.
So
the most disturbing thing is not even that she complained to your boss. She had her mom do it. She doesn't know. She's a grown up now. Okay, if you want to lodge a complaint, you're the one who should do it. These kids aren't making their own in college. They're not able to make their own appointments with the doctor to get their re-up of psych meds. They're having their mom do it because they say they have social phobia. And I interviewed a wonderful psych nurse about it who deals with all these universities in the Boston area. And she told me they don't have social phobia. They've just been so over-tended by mom or dad. And they've never done anything for themselves. And that's what we're seeing. That's treatment dependency. Kids who are so over, you know, handled by an expert or by an authority figure, they don't know they can do for themselves.
Who is suffering more emotionally? Kids that come from extremely conservative homes or extremely liberal ones?
We actually have some research on this, which is interesting. It's not my research. It's out of Jean Twenge's book called Generations. And she is no conservative, but she points out that apparently, even though teen girl mental health is the worst overall, teen boys from liberal families have worse mental health than teen girls from conservative families. Now, right there, you know, that's not social media. Teen girls are on way more social media than boys. Okay. So why would that be? So there are a couple of ideas that have been suggested. One, of course, we know that conservative families tend to be more religious, tend to be more authoritative. But they also tend not to turn their family over to a mental health expert quite as quickly.
Well, I'm also thinking about the feminization of parenting or having more masculine energy in the house. Even if you have a two-parent household of a male and female in a liberal house, I feel like it could lean more towards more effeminate energy than in a traditionally conservative home. Is that crazy to think?
It's not crazy. The biggest difference between this generation of parents, let's say millennials, is that the dads are so different. The dads are always aping the mom. They have had their confidence in their own ways of handling things completely undercut. They don't have trust themselves to do things a little differently.
The mom is the domineering person in the relationship.
Well, when it comes, she's setting the tone for the parenting. So there used to be what I call a dad style. And by the way, it was practiced by women too, which was sort of a knock it off, shake it off parent who was willing to say to the kid, you'll live, you're fine for minor things. The problem is not that every parent isn't saying it. The problem today is that no parent is saying that.
You discovered that kids who are joining politically extreme groups, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, they're not coming from conservative families. Where are they coming from?
So very often, this was, you know, both in people I interviewed, but also going back to a wonderful book by Midge Dechter, actually, in I believe the 1980s, called Liberal Parents, Radical Children. They're coming from liberal families. And, when I spoke to an expert in dealing with these kids who have been fallen into extremist groups like ISIS, Antifa, very often they come from liberal families. They actually come from the most gentle families and parents who never wanted to say no to their kids. And, you know, as one person put it to me, you know, when they don't hear no, they go looking for daddy somewhere else. And the thing about radical movements is they will give you rules. They will give you firm rules. And very often young people are craving that.
When somebody is craving an authority figure and we're looking at kind of minority neighborhoods, a lot of times we see that with gangs, kids joining gangs to have that family atmosphere, right? But then the kids that are joining these really fringe political movements, Antifa, the like, I feel like they are typically white and they're coming from these affluent liberal homes. I mean, does that sound right?
It does track with my understanding, you know, based on my, you know, I'm a journalist, but based on, you know, people I've interviewed, yes, that very often it is coming from liberal, you know, certainly non-authoritative and very gentle homes where you know, the rules weren't set down clearly. And so the kids go looking for them elsewhere. Now, we're seeing that in the news. I don't know how, representative that is, but according to the interviews I've done, it does seem to be. So we know that the rising generation is more radical. They're more politically radical, both on the right and on the left, but especially on the left. The biggest growth has been an attraction to far left movements. So part of that, of course, is because of social media. But I do think that part of it's also the way they've been raised. These kids are craving structure.
Did you talk to any parents of kids who have like joined Antifa and asked them, like, do you think, you know, how did you parent? Were you surprised by this?
No, I interviewed people who've worked with families that have fallen into this.
Okay.
So, you know, I interviewed, so, you know, people who have talked to, let's say, dozens, if not hundreds of families.
I don't know if you saw this story in the last couple of days, but there was a 59-year-old Houston woman who is currently fighting for her life. A 12-year-old boy came into her driveway, stabbed her. The boy's mother tells the news, well, he's just a boy. We all learn from our mistakes. My question for you was, he was charged with aggravated assault, but do you think that that falls into gentle parenting possibly?
You know, I'll say this, that the emotional dysregulation, the violence, the chaos that teachers are reporting in public school, they say is at a level they haven't seen before. So if you interview teachers, they will tell you this, that violence is being totally uncontrolled. Now, where did we get this? Well, in 2014, Obama wrote a Dear Colleague letter in which he threatened public schools that he would cut off their funding if they kept disproportionately expelling and suspending minority kids. And so what did the public schools do? They came up with a program which was called Restorative Justice. So instead of a disciplinary system where if you're violent in class, you get suspended or expelled or you have detention, now the answer was we're going to treat it with mental health.
And is this rule still in place?
Absolutely. The approach in schools is trauma-informed care. The idea is that every child who acts out, the only reason you would act out is if you were traumatized. You must be in emotional pain. That's where it's coming from. And so therefore, every kid is given a kind of therapy. And what are the schools clamoring for now? more mental health resources. So this has been a disaster. There was a great Rand meta study showing that restorative justice has been a disaster. It has not improved violence. If anything, violence has escalated at these schools. But nonetheless, we're pouring more and more mental health resources into the schools. The kids are getting a whole lot more therapy, which is a whole lot more feelings focus. And yes, more dysregulation, more depression, more anxiety, because that's what comes out of feelings focus. That's what comes out of thinking about me all the time. And by the way, there's great psychological research on that. We know that sitting around thinking about yourself, rehearsing your pain, that's a great way to make you more depressed and more dysregulated.
I have questions about discipline. Did you look into at all what happens to kids who were spanked as children and how they end up turning out?
It's a great question. No one else has asked that because spanking has become so verboten that you can't even talk about it.
I love that I am the one with all my interviews. I will inevitably ask something the guest says, you know, nobody else has been brave enough to ask it.
That's right. So here's the thing that I will tell you. I don't know about how efficacious spanking is. Okay. I haven't seen good data on that spanking is helpful. I haven't. So I don't recommend it. But does it cause trauma? There's not good research on that. Now, things are a little different today because everyone believes that spanking traumatizes a child. And if we all accept as a culture that necessarily, and we communicate to kids, that will cause you trauma, then we can talk a kid into a sort of traumatic, you know, injury of sorts. And look, there's a wonderful new piece of research out by this wonderful researcher named Kathy Wydom, who does these prospective studies with kids. This is the only rigorous form of study. She looked at kids who went through a traumatic experience. She documented it. And then with a team of researchers blinded to which group they were in, whether they had actually gone through a traumatic experience or not, they re-interviewed them as adults. And what she found was that adults who believed that, whose life narrative did not include that incident, in other words, they didn't think it was a big deal, they did better in life. They were happier, more successful adults. And adults who thought they had been traumatized as kids were much more likely to suffer, even if it turned out they were misremembering. So the narrative we build around trauma, teaching kids as we're doing in schools today, that they've been traumatized, is the most dangerous thing we could be doing for them emotionally.
Not spanking is what you're saying. Sounds like it's other things.
It's even worse. It's definitely worse than spanking, is teaching a kid they've been traumatized.
What is responsible for creating this phenomenon of gentle parenting?
Well, it's therapists. I mean, by and large, it's psychologists or neuropsychologists or therapists telling parents they don't understand the brain. I do. And by the way, we never get to see the product of their amazing methods, you know, ostensibly amazing methods. Sometimes these parenting gurus will say, my oldest child is 9.
That is true. I've never met somebody who is, you know, a thriving 27-year-old who was the product of gentle parenting.
Right. And here's what I want parents to know. I'm not a parenting expert, but please do not listen to someone whose oldest child is 9. They are not a parenting expert. You know who's a parenting expert? Not me. Someone who has actually raised young children to adulthood.
Successfully.
Successfully. Right. Productive adults. People who can be relied upon by others. Good friends. Good neighbors. Show up for work on time. Load-bearing walls.
It also seems like everybody who's obsessed with gentle parenting and says it's worked so well for their kids have one kid. It's one child to try this on.
It's very time intensive because they will say things like, if your child's screaming and flailing, don't punish them because that will be damaging. Hug them, hold them and hug them for as long. Well, if you have more than one kid, you can't lie on the floor in a bear hug with your 9-year-old, right? You have two other kids and maybe dinner going. It's not practicable. So yes, it's an extremely intensive thing that has very suspicious, indications that it's actually working for anyone.
You actually have seen parents ask questions that are involved in gentle parenting groups that say things like, so does anyone have any advice on how to get a 3-year-old to accept the consequences?
Right. And the answer is always, your child may have a diagnosis.
Are you serious?
Always. If you go to these chats, I think she sounds a little spectrum-y to me. That sounds a little like ADHD. She may have sensory processing issues because it's not just the official diagnoses anymore. Now these diagnoses are proliferating, right? So it's sensory processing issues, not quite a disorder. But now we have to rearrange our lives around it and be more and more. It's a sensitive child, they will tell you. And parents, you know, it's flattering to the parents to think they have recognized a sensitive kid. The problem is they're creating the hypersensitive kid.
Well, and you talked about how, too, instead of just saying yes or no, or, you know, saying like, this is your punishment or whatever, these parents that are all worried about their kids accepting consequences, they're like, well, I've tried everything. I gave them, you know, sad chores, or I don't know, redirected them, and they do everything basically besides say no.
Right. They have a calming corner. I think the results are a catastrophe, to be honest, of gentle parenting. But there's a bigger catastrophe, because you send a dysregulated kid who's never heard the word no off to school. Well, now a teacher has to control 25 children.
There is an unprecedented attack on anyone sharing information in the media right now that is antithetical to the typical pill for an ill dogma. They want you to believe that being sick is normal. You know, it's normal to be tired all the time. Women getting cancer younger and younger is not concerning. Suffering from serious hormonal issues is just what it's like to be a woman. This big pharma groupthink is hurting women. I believe this, and so does feminine product company Garnu. Garnu tampons and pads are made from 100% organic cotton. No glyphosate, no dyes, no chlorine, no fragrance, all of which contribute to a daily reduction in parabens and phthalates, which can reverse the accumulation of cancer, according to a 2022 PubMed study. It is so important for women to lessen our toxin load as much as we can, and a great place to start is with products used in the most absorbent areas of our body. Garnu offers light and super tampons, pads, overnight pads, and panty liners, free of the chemicals you want to avoid down there. Plus, Garnu is a conservative-owned company. Your custom box of period products can arrive monthly just in time for Strawberry Week. No more late-night drugstore runs. Just Garnu. Go to Garnu.com with code Alex for 15% off your order. That's GARNUU.com with code Alex for 15% off your non-toxic period products. Or find the link in the show notes. Sometimes some of these school counselors are asking the kids to spy on their parents and report back.
Well, yes. I mean, the thing to know is that everyone at school is a mandatory reporter, and kids are meeting with counselors. They're coming in doing social emotional learning now. And what is social emotional learning? It's a therapeutic intervention which gets kids into a kind of group therapy. Now, you might say, well, why should that be? They're asking kids all about emotions. They're teaching emotional regulation. Well, if they're asking kids, think about a time when you're happy, there's not much to teach for emotional regulation. So it always goes negative. Now tell me about a time when you were disappointed, rejected, bullied, felt pain. So now you're encouraging a bad habit in terms of, you know, mentally bad habit, dwelling on past pain, which we said was the number one symptom of depression. Okay, so now you're doing that with a... So now... The next natural question is, whose job is it to keep you safe? You were emotionally injured, mom and dad. So now the question is, well, where were they?
Oh my gosh.
So no matter how good the intentions, and I do believe most kids, people who work with kids have good intentions, these programs in schools, these mental health interventions in schools are a menace.
See, but then what if the kid is, what do these reports look like when they ask them to spy on the kid? Like, is it like, write down everything your parent does when you get home from school type of a thing?
Talk about a time when you were sad. Talk about a time when a caregiver, they always call parents caregivers, right? That's the demotion for you.
If you're actual parent is only your caregiver, then anyone can become your parent.
That's
or
right.
Caregiver.
So they now talk about trusted adults. The school counselor is identified as a trusted adult, but your parents in these exercises are typically called caregivers, meaning just service providers. And that's where the demotion in the kids' feelings for the parent comes, okay? And this isn't just my feelings. While I was writing a book, two teams of researchers I didn't know about were looking into the same things. They were looking into social emotional learning techniques and emotional coping techniques tried out with kids in Australia and in England. And after I finished the book, they came out with the results. And the results were that just teaching things like anti-bullying techniques, emotional regulation, coping techniques, that was enough to cause kids to be sadder, to be more anxious, and to be alienated from mom and dad more than the control group. They followed these kids.
Is social emotional learning what education majors are learning in American colleges?
Almost every single public school is teaching now, and many, many, many private schools. And by the way, they are now demanding, every time they look at the mental health of this generation, they are demanding more and more resources. These kids need less. They need less of the medication. They need less of the therapy. They need to be told, you're strong. And here's what I want people to know. Not only is it not helping the kids who didn't start out with a problem, it's not helping the kid who did face adversity. Because you know what? A child who's just lost a parent, having a counselor casually inquire about the death of his mom right before he has to take an algebra test is not helpful. It's counterproductive.
You have some other ethical concerns about the school counselors and social emotional learning. It's an ethical problem for the therapist that you talk to also know all of your friends, all of your teachers.
That's right. There's this long-term ethical prohibition on something called dual relationships. Therapists are not allowed to be your sister, meaning if they're your sister, they can't have you in therapy. Why? Why can't they be your neighbor and your therapist? If you're their neighbor, they can't take you on as a patient. And why? Because they could have too much power over you. They know all your secrets. They see your spouse or your boyfriend every day, right? The abuse of power is just, it's too tempting. It's too great. So the profession generally makes them off limits, dual relationships. The problem with school counselors is they have a dual relationship with every kid who walks in the door. They know all the kids' teachers. They know the kids' parents. They know the kids' friends. They know the kid who they may have been dating and broken up with, and they know what happened. So they are in a position, whether they're doing it or not, to exert an enormous amount of power over the kids' lives. And what are they doing now? They're running interference with teachers. As soon as they hear a kid's struggling, they go running into the teacher. I don't think she can handle a math test today. It's the opposite of what we should be doing with kids.
I mean, when I was growing up, we also had school counselors.
Right.
Do you feel like they've always been a bad idea, or has something changed recently with school counselors?
It's changed.
Okay.
So what we used to think of the school guidance counselor was, it's someone you could seek out if you really had a problem.
Right.
If you were really struggling.
Yeah, they never talked to me unless I went to them.
Right. That's how it was, and that's how it should have been.
Okay.
I'm not saying don't have a resource there, but we need to shrink these counseling staffs so they're not over-treating every child.
There was one chapter where you talked about teenage boys all needing help putting on a clip-on tie, and that the teacher told you that they can't even go across the street to get fast food on their own. They say, well, I don't know how.
Right.
What is going on with this emotional stunting of teenagers
That's
in America?
Right. They feel unwell. They have something like 42% has a mental health diagnosis. The number of them have convinced themselves, less than half of this generation says its mental health is good. They don't feel up to challenges. And why can't they try a tie? They're afraid to do anything without asking an expert. They have been told again and again, we'll sort out your problems. You can't handle anything.
But why are they saying they don't know how to go across the street and go to Chipotle?
Because they've never been able to do it.
What's that? I don't even understand that.
Parents never gave them any independence.
But these kids don't have a job at 15, 16?
No. They don't.
And they don't drive.
And they don't drive. And they don't feel they can. In fact, boys at 17 are telling their moms that driving is scary. We have absolutely incapacitated a generation. And we need to remove a lot of the over-treatment of this generation.
Let's talk about this obsession that we have with trauma as a culture. Everyone knows the saying, the body keeps score. Now, they're saying that our trauma goes back as far as our ancestors and that it manifests physically. I've actually never heard anyone be critical of that until I read your book. You are critical of it. Why do you think that that isn't true?
So it isn't true. But here's what I want to say. People who make that claim, they make a lot of headway moving between, and they never own up to this, metaphor and a clear scientific claim. So what they do is they say, you know, if your ancestors were hurt, you carry that trauma in your body. Well, it's often not clear. Are they speaking literally? Because literally the answer is no.
Yeah, they're saying like back pain and stuff.
Right. They're saying back pain. In your uterus, you carry the pain of your ancestors. Now, conveniently, this obviously works with a certain amount of wokeism, right? Because we're all, if that's true, then we're then today's generations can be experiencing slavery in their bodies, right? So it's very convenient. It's also not true, by the way. There's no good research on this. If it were true that our bodies were marked by trauma, permanently, epigenetically transmissible from generations, then none of us would be flourishing. We wouldn't be here. Why? Because things like death of a parent, death of a sibling, incredible poverty and deprivation, they are the story of every family. And you know what else is the story of every family? Resilience. Mm-hmm. Picking yourself up and overcoming and going out there and being a strong adult who can support others and help others. Now, does that mean that no one ever has PTSD? No. We know that some small percentage of combat soldiers, for instance, may have PTSD or survivors of a real traumatic sudden incident. They may have symptoms of PTSD and they may suffer with it. Absolutely. The problem is that every kid today who goes through anything hard thinks they have PTSD and they don't.
Has that been the most controversial part of your book, or what in the book has given you the most pushback from other people?
Mostly, it's been a giant sigh of relief. And let me tell you, the number of doctors and researchers who have come out of the woodwork to tell me that they loved the section where I go after the trauma gurus because it never made any sense and they've been dying for someone to attack it is shocking.
Are we overdosing sensory issues in kids?
Yes. Yes. And what we're doing is the opposite. Rather than what's worked, and cognitive behavioral therapists know this, exposure therapy, right? Exposing kids to a certain amount of distress, letting them handle. Oh, I don't like that noise at night. You don't run and buy a soft sound machine and blot out all the noise. Oh, I don't like the tag at the back of my shirt. You don't cut out all the tags. Why? Because you're going to make a kid more intolerant of the normal stresses and distress in life. If you constantly, you know, treat your kid like the boy in the bubble, then the kid is going to become more and more, vulnerable. And that's not what we want. We want to build strong kids. Happy kids are strong kids. We want to make them strong.
What about the people that say, well, I think I have an exceptionally sensitive child?
Right. And then they're getting that result because they're talking their kid into sensitivity. Unfortunately, a sensitive child is very often an unhappy child, too. So we said happiness was our goal. It was never a good goal. If you make happiness your goal, you will be unhappy. There's really good research for that. But let me tell you, make your kids strong and you can worry a whole lot less.
What are the Japanese parents doing that American parents should be copying?
Japanese parents have done so many interesting things, and their young people are much better at emotional regulation.
Okay? Well, that one show on Netflix,
yes.
They've got 2-year-olds yeah. running errands in public
That's
alone.
Right. That's right.
I love that show.
And I interviewed a woman who's a cross-cultural expert in emotion. She's a psychologist at Georgetown University, Julia Chensova-Dutton. And one of the things she told me is it's basically accurate that Japanese believe in making their kids strong. How do they do that? How do they foster independence? Their preschools have areas, they have things that are a little dangerous, like rocks, boulders, and streams, where kids will get a little hurt. They might get a little hurt. That's okay. They want them to see that it's not a catastrophe. They have areas of their preschools where the teacher can't see, and they encourage kids to work out their own squabbles. And they do that because they need kids to learn socialization. They need to learn how to do that. They don't want these 19-year-olds that are calling mom because they had a fight with a friend.
Nobody should go into Western parenting experts. We should really be looking elsewhere.
Here's how I would put it. Look at previous generations. Look at our grandparents and great-grandparents. They were so strong. They were so positive, right? If you look back at the boomers, they were a really happy generation. And they had not had the easiest childhoods necessarily. And you go back a generation before that, and they really had a hard childhood. And these were really happy, productive people that we could all be proud of.
Yeah, that's very true. Life hack alert! Your favorite non-toxic brand just launched something new and amazing. Alevia, my favorite organic prebiotic body care line, just launched their Rosewater Luxe Mist. They combine their proprietary prebiotic base with a 10 times stronger prebiotic concentration than their prebiotic body washes to feed and nourish your skin's microbiome. Whoa, that was a mouthful, but all you need to know is Oh, this stuff works, baby. The coconut oil, organic rose water, organic rose essential oil, and aloe vera are aerated in a soft water mist that lands gently on the skin and evaporates into the air, leaving the powerful organic ingredients to settle on your skin and naturally help relieve the symptoms of your eczema, rosacea, psoriasis, or really dry, sensitive skin. I use this all over my body and face. Alevia Rosewater Luxe Mist also promotes collagen reproduction and works to restore the damage caused by age and everyday chemicals. It's 100% natural and organic, non-toxic, GMO-free, chemical and paraben-free, free of all fragrances and dyes, contains no animal byproducts, and vegan and cruelty-free. Alevia's Rosewater Luxe Mist is great for reducing lines and wrinkles in mature skin, can be used on face and body, and provides great UV protection from the sun when combined with an SPF because of its antioxidant power. It's also just fabulous to spritz throughout the day on the go or as part of your morning routine. Go to Alevia.com to find all of their organic prebiotic products to help feed your skin's microbiome. Use code ALEX15 for 15% off. Alevia.com with code ALEX15 or find the link in the description. I loved this passage in the book. That's what a happy childhood is, experiencing all the pains of adulthood in smaller doses so that they build up an immunity to the poison of heartache and loss. So many parents believe the opposite, that our kids cannot feel or experience any pain whatsoever, or else they've been failed. And then that means they didn't have a happy childhood.
Right. But just talk to any adult who says, I had my heart broken in second grade. You talk to anybody of pre-teen, I was crazy about this girl or boy and he didn't like me back. And it wasn't devastating. It made them stronger. Right? These relationships that don't work out, talk to anyone who's been through one and gotten through in the other end. They usually say, now I know what I'm looking for. Right? These experiences do make us stronger, but if we shield our kid from every distress, every painful experience, every time they're teased, we rush in and complain to the other child's mom. Mm. We call it bullying to them and make it so grandiose in their minds. Then ordinary adult stress will overwhelm them. They won't develop the musculature. We want these kids to develop emotional musculature. Sticks and stones may break my bones. I haven't heard that in I don't know how many decades.
Yeah, words do now, we're told, harm us.
Right. Kids should be told the opposite. You're going to be fine. She called you a mean name. So what? Don't worry about it.
What is your advice for parents who currently have their kid in therapy?
So it depends. Does the child, have you tried to stabilize the child without therapy? Do they have a real problem? Okay. If you can't stabilize your child, whether it's anorexia or any number of disorders, where it's severe, by all means, then the question is, what kind of therapy? And then I would take a serious look at the efficacy of that therapy and how many sessions, and interviewed the therapist seriously. But everyone should be aware that therapy comes with a series of known harms. You should check, is my child's anxiety getting worse? But here's another thing. Don't let your kid sit with a therapist for years with ambiguous goals if she doesn't need it.
I'm sure that there are a lot of parents listening who are thinking, what if I've messed up? What if I have a young adult child or a teenage child now, and I did have them in therapy for years and years?
Look, I can't pretend that it's easy to turn things around if your child's already in college, because that's really far along. But there's a really hopeful story here, and this is the easiest thing to fix. It's so easy. We know how to raise good kids in this country. We've been doing it for generations. Great people to adulthood. People who never knew about the amygdala, okay? And we can do it again. And all I'm saying is go back, ask your parents what they did. Ask your aunt and uncle, ask your grandparents or great-grandparents, see what they did. But also tell your kids what your family went through. We need to reverse the message. And the message has to be, you come from tough people and you can get through hard things too.
Where can people get your book and follow you on social media?
The book's called Bad Therapy. It's available wherever books are sold, Amazon, anywhere. And you can follow me on Twitter at Abigail Schreier.
Any hints on what you think you want to cover next in your next book? Or you're like, this book is still, just came out. I'm not even thinking about the next one yet.
I promise to let you know. I'll get back to you on
that. Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Abigail, for coming on The Spillover.
Oh, really? It was a great fun.
If this is your first time ever hearing of Abigail Schreier, my first interview with her and both of her books are completely groundbreaking. She's one of the last real journalists out there. I truly believe that. My first interview with her is season one, episode two. Next week, I'm tackling what, funnily enough, has become one of the most controversial food trends on the internet. I am doing an entire episode on raw milk. With a raw dairy farmer, is it actually more nutritious than pasteurized milk? Are there any serious health risks? Why did we start pasteurizing milk in the first place? And how do you even get it? That's going to be a really fun one to trigger the masses. Look for that anywhere you listen to podcasts or The Real Alex Clark YouTube next Thursday at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern. I'm starting to wonder if I should start releasing the episodes earlier on Thursday evenings, though. What do you think about that? Every link that you need pertaining to this episode, any of the ads that I read, any links for Abigail, you can always find that in the show notes, including where to find like-minded friends who love listening to the show. I'm Alex Clark, and this is The Spillover. Love you, mean it. Bye.
Because you send a dysregulated kid who's never heard the word no off to school. Well, now a teacher has to control 25 children. She can't spend the whole day dealing with, you know, Braden's emotional, you know, outbursts. So what is she going to do? She's going to recommend him for medication.
That camera guy's name is Braden. So funny. I knew I could see my peripheral that you're like,